Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're going to talk about air quality, link that to the 2034 Salt Lake Winter Olympic Games, as did the authors of a new paper. We have three USU researchers in studio with us. This paper is slated to publish in the August edition of the journal Sustainability and Climate Change. The title of the paper is The Utah 2034 Winter Olympics, Leaving a Lasting Clean Air Legacy. And so we are joined by three USU researchers. I'll just have you introduce yourselves. Tell me your name and kind of your expertise. So we'll start with Ed Stafford.
Thank you very much for your interest in our work. I'm Edwin Stafford. I'm a marketing professor in the Huntsman School of Business at Utah State University.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. So I'm Rosalyn Brain, and I'm a professor in Environment Society and a Sustainable Communities Extension Specialist.
All right.
And I'm Randy Martin over in the civil environmental engineering world, and I do all things air quality over there.
Okay. Let me start with you, Edwin Stafford. So you wanted to link air quality to the Olympics, and you begin with an anecdote, right? The 2002
yes,
Winter
yes.
Olympics, and I think we I don't know if I remembered this until I read your paper, but we dodged a bullet there.
Yes, yes, we did, and I think people are not aware of this story. But back in 2002, the day before the opening ceremony, Salt Lake had a terrible inversion cloud, and Fraser Bullock, who was one of the leaders of putting on the Olympics, was panicked because this was supposed to be Utah's introduction to the world. You know, we had just 6 months earlier, we had 9/11. And so, staging the Olympics so quickly after that tragic event was very important, not just to Utah, but for the entire country. And he was concerned that instead of people focused on this fantastic opening ceremony, that that the world's cameras would be focused on the pollution that had engulfed the Salt Lake Valley. We had a stroke of good luck. A snowstorm came in, blew out all the pollution, and we had glorious weather for 17 days afterwards. But I was concerned as I was watching the Paris Olympics in 2024 when I saw that the Seine River created all sorts of disruptions for the Paris Olympics. There was the men's triathlon that got canceled, but then was reinstated once the Seine River's pollution levels improved, but people swam in it and got sick. And I started worrying about what would potentially be a disruption to Utah's games, and I immediately thought of air pollution.
There's some urgency here, right? The Paris Olympic Committee started several years before. They thought they would have time. They did correct the problem the next year after the Olympics, but not in time for the Olympics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think what's important to look at this is that, past Olympics have been a political lever for communities, for cities, in our case, for our state, to potentially take on big initiatives such as cleaning up the Seine River or cleaning up our air pollution. And so I think that is one of the opportunities that we have, and that's why we published this paper.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get fairly soon here into suggested solutions. One more thing on the Olympics, the Beijing Olympics, they had a summer games that where they tried to scramble with their air quality and didn't quite make it. And then later on, they had a winter games where they were a little more successful, I guess.
Yes, yeah. No, and that, I think if you look at Olympics over the past several years, or more than that, the last 30 years or so, we've seen that that air pollution has been an issue for many of the communities. And so in Beijing for 2008, many of the Olympians, many of the athletes chose not to even stay in Beijing because they were worried that the air pollution would actually impact their performance. And so they would fly in, do the event, and then fly out. I hope that doesn't happen here in Utah, but, that shows the extreme measures that athletes will take in order to make sure that they can perform at their peak.
So maybe we could do a bit of a primer on air quality. I think we've heard about this a lot. We've experienced it, right, especially during inversions, wintertime inversions. Randy Martin, maybe you can tackle this one. I was learning reading this paper. I hadn't quite realized. I know what an inversion is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But under normal conditions, warm and cool air tend to kind of, you know, alternate, right? And
right.
So that's a healthier condition.
Just to get down to the basics. Normally, when you go up in altitude in the atmosphere, the air cools. And it's just like on a hot summer day, we here would like to go up to, say, Tony Grove and be in a little bit cooler air. In an inverted situation, it's just the opposite. You have cold air trapped below warm air, and there can be no vertical mixing when that happens. And so when that occurs, which really occurs any day of the year, just in the summertime, for example, it breaks up as soon as the sun comes up and warms up the valley floors. But in the wintertime, we don't have that advantage. And so that warm air or cold air stays trapped below the warm air. We don't get that mixing. And so whatever we put into that inversion tends to grow over time and create our air pollution problems. And in the wintertime, both here along the Wasatch Front, we end up with elevated PM2.5 particles in the air. And it's, most of those are photochemically formed from oxides of nitrogen, hydrocarbons, and ammonia, which we have in abundance. And so the longer those inversions stick around, the higher and higher the pollutant concentrations can climb.
Let me pause at the PM2.5.
Okay.
What are the so I understand these particles can get into the bloodstream?
Right. PM2.5, by definition, are all particles suspended in the air of 2.5 microns and smaller. So that's 2.5 micron particles, roughly about 1/30th to 1/40th the diameter of a human hair. And so those particles tend to stay suspended in the air for a long time because they're very light. And then that's the magic size that we can actually breathe into our respiratory system, and they can go through all the twists and turns of our respiratory systems and get down to the very bottom of our alveoli sacs, which is where the oxygen blood exchange. And if the particles are actually smaller than about 1 micron, they can transfer directly into the capillaries and go throughout your circulatory system. Mm-hmm. So it's those very small particles that cause a lot of our problems.
We have PM10, is that
PM10,
correct?
So
larger but still
that's
dangerous.
Larger, yeah. PM10, the thing to keep about particles in the air, that's actually a continuum. So PM2.5 is a subset of PM10. So you have ranges between 2.5 and 10 that you can breathe in. We started regulating PM10 in the early 1990s. Because at that time, that was a science. The science said that's the size you breathe into your body. But then as science progressed, we learned that the stuff between 2.5 and 10 microns sort of gets trapped in the upper respiratory tract. So it's more of a nuisance, and it deposits in the phlegm and the mucus material in the top of your lung system, and you tend to cough that back out and spit it back out. So it's that smaller size that gets down into the deep lung tissue. PM10 is not health-free. But it's an issue, like I say, that gets trapped in the upper part of your body, and it's the 2.5 and smaller that gets down to the lower part of your body.
And then we have problematic is not a good word, bad dust, dangerous dust.
Dangerous, annoying
from
dust.
From the playa of the Great Salt Lake,
right,
for example.
I am hesitant. A lot of people will use toxic dust, and I'm hesitant to use that word toxic because toxic implies exposure time, toxicity of the chemicals within the dust. And so you can be exposed to playa dust for a short period of time, and it's more of a nuisance than actually a health impact at the time. But if you average that over 40 years of a lifetime, then it can add up. So it's an issue, and it's something we need to be aware of and study a little bit more to understand what's happening there, including all the other things that we now suspect are also in the particles, like PFAS compounds, microplastics. So it's not something we can ignore, but using the word, say, toxic is a little bit of a stretch, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Forever chemicals, does that fit in here?
That's the PFAS
compounds. That's the PFAS compounds.
Yep, those are the forever chemicals.
Yeah.
They're everywhere, and we're trying to now see, we've got a study that we're just starting up, to see are they also embedded in the playa dust, and if so, what happens when that gets airborne?
Mm-hmm. No, in your paper, you guys talk about where Utah's ranked. We're not ranked very good. We're known for our bad air quality. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the specifics, but
the American Lung Association every year comes out with their report, usually in April or so, called State of the Air, and In Utah, we've been making progress. I think in Cache Valley, we're, don't quote me on this number, I think we're like number 17 on the list now, where we have been in the four, five, seven area. I think Salt Lake is really close to this in PM 2.5. Salt Lake is in the top 10, maybe 11 for ozone, summertime ozone. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the situation's well known.
Okay. Now, some people listening might be saying, well, didn't the EPA recently certify Wasatch Front or Salt Lake area is in compliance after many years of noncompliance?
After many years of noncompliance, yes. We've met the 35 micrograms per cubic meter threshold, not by much. Hmm. So I would not qualify the air as healthy overall. We're still in that mostly yellow type category, but we do meet that threshold based on the last several years of data. So it's real. It's true data. But that doesn't mean, analogy I like to use, you don't take your foot off the gas pedal. You keep all these programs in place that we have to mitigate our pollution that we're putting in the air. And things are not necessarily going to get better in the future as we get more and more people, more and more cars on the road. Cars are driving farther. Now, the other side of that is we're using better gasoline in the vehicles. There's more electric vehicles around. So there's competing interests in whether we're adding to the pollution or reducing it. But it's not something we can ignore. It's not going to get better if we ignore it.
Let's finger the culprits. What's causing this air pollution?
Lots of things. Roughly 47 to 50% of the pollutants that we emit into the atmosphere come from the mobile sources, so planes, trains, automobiles. About 40 or so percent are what we call area sources. So those are houses, businesses, those type of things. And then small businesses, I should say. Restaurants, auto body shops, paint shops. But then about 15 or so percent, maybe it's actually 13, come from stationary sources, so the large smokestacks. So it's a shared amount of emissions, but mostly, if you want to point one thing, it's the automobiles. And so that's one thing where everybody can contribute to solving the problem.
Anything else you two would like to say on the scope of the problem before we jump into solutions?
Yeah, just to go back a little to the air quality issues in the history of the Olympics, 15 to 30% of Olympic athletes have sports-induced asthma. And when you have a poor air event, it will amplify those symptoms. And so it is a serious concern. There was a famous event that happened in 1984 in the Los Angeles Olympics where we had an 800-meter runner collapse after the event. And that was associated with the poor air quality during that time. And it would just... We have enough time now. We have 8 years before the Olympics occur, and we'll talk about the solutions we are presenting here in the article we're referencing. But really, it comes down to a couple major things: some bold policies and financial incentives around adopting these strategies that we'll talk about in the next while.
Yeah, that was a famous incident, and maybe we bring this in right here before we go to break. The Olympic movement has instituted rules, right? So that the Olympics right now, the committees commit to, I don't know what you call it, Green Olympics or?
Absolutely. So back in 1986, the Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, actually adopted policies to institute environmental quality initiatives. And so those are in place and those are expected when you put together or when you host the games that these Olympic, these environmental policies will be implemented for the games. Mm-hmm. And so, it's been a struggle. Some cities have done better than others. Sydney 2000 Summer Olympics were quite a milestone. Those were considered to be the first green games. Largely because Sydney got the what was awarded the Olympics because of the environmental initiatives that it was proposing. And many of those are a legacy today. They have an Olympic village that still houses about 5,000 Sydney residents that was all completely solar powered. They had earthworms that were eating, garbage. They had all sorts of, public transportation. So at that time, again, this was back in 2000, that was a considered state-of-the-art in terms of various environmental policies that had instituted into that particular event. And so here we are today as we're preparing for 2034. And so we have a set of 8 proposals that we have that we believe can leave a lasting legacy.
Now, I think I know in the paper you say that that's great, that the Olympic movement is on board, but it's probably not going to be sufficient. This is the footprint of just Salt Lake areas. A commitment there is probably not going to be enough.
You know, we need to have everybody on board to help us with that, whether it's the legislature, where it's various cities, where it's Olympic sponsors, and even citizens will be able to, contribute to these particular programs.
Let's take a break. We are talking about air quality, and in connection with the 2034 Salt Lake Winter Olympics, it's coming up in just 8 years. We have with us 3 USU professors, researchers, Rosalind Brain, Randy Martin, and Edwin Stafford, and they are authors of a paper in the Journal of Sustainability and Climate Change. It's titled The Utah 2034 Winter Olympics, Leaving a Lasting Clean Air Legacy. Following break, we'll get into solutions that they're proposing. More following this.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Ada Ferrer on Keeper of My Kin, a family memoir shaped by exile, love, and history.
I am who I am now because the Cuban Revolution happened, because my parents made this very difficult decision, because of the way other family stories unfolded.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Tune in Tuesday morning at 11 here on UPR.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. Do you know our show? Okay. Well, either way, I'm going to tell you about it. We make stories, old-fashioned stories that hopefully pull you in at the beginning with funny moments and feelings and people in surprising situations, and then you just want to find out what is going to happen and cannot stop listening. That's right. I'm talking about stories that make you miss appointments and ignore your loved ones. This American Life.
Tune in Saturday mornings at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about air quality on the program today. We have with us authors of a paper in the Journal of Sustainability and Climate Change titled The Utah 2034 Winter Olympics, Leaving a Lasting Clean Air Legacy. The authors say that this is a great opportunity, some leverage to try to get meaningful change in cleaning up our air in Utah, and that leverage coming from the 2034 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. So a couple of things on harmful effects of air pollution before we get into solutions that I forgot to bring forward. This I hadn't really focused on before. Apparently, we suspect that we might be eating hazardous dust.
There's been some recent studies that have come out about the Salt Lake Playa dust making it up into our agricultural areas and depositing onto particularly broadleaf vegetables. And so once it's deposited there, it becomes part of that plant material. And yeah, there's potential evidence showing that it can make it to your dinner plate.
Yeah, wow. Cyclosporiasis, right? That's not enough. Would put me off leafy vegetables permanently. Although I don't want to disparage that. Let's all eat our greens, right? Let's do that. Let's make sure we're safe. One more thing. Not particularly on our health, but affecting our snow. This is an effect where, I guess, dust or air, you know, bad air particulates land in the snow and make it more reflective.
Greatly depends on what the dust is made up of and what it looks
like. Or less reflective, I guess.
It can make it look reflective. It can add to the absorption of the solar energy onto the sun or into the snow and then melt it prematurely.
Yeah. All right. Anything else I'm forgetting on the bad stuff about air quality? Well, let's get into some solutions. In this paper, you outline at least 8 potential solutions. You call them opportunities, right? So let's start, as you do in the paper, with electrifying transportation. You're talking about electric vehicles here?
Yes. As Randy mentioned, 47 to 50% of our air pollution comes from automobiles, comes from transportation. And so if we can eliminate the on-vehicle burning of of fossil fuels. So that way it's electrified, that can eliminate those particular emissions. And so that is probably our biggest and most important opportunity that we have. There are barriers to electric vehicle adoption. Probably one of the biggest ones is that people don't perceive that there's sufficient charging infrastructure. So our second proposal is that we need to expand electric charging infrastructure so people will feel confident that they can charge anywhere where they need to in order to accommodate having and traveling and relying on an electric vehicle.
I think that is a big barrier, and charging stations tend to be along the I-15 corridor, I guess mostly in Utah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Although they're also in our community. Smith's just opened up a battery of Tesla charging infrastructure, and that's every time I drive by it, it's well used. So people mm-hmm. are using it, and so I think we just need more of those types of things. So if people visually see that they can charge their car when they're shopping for food, that becomes a barrier that they can see that's being eliminated because they can have access to those charging
stations. Research supports that as well. Yeah. If you look at bike infrastructure, if you improve bike infrastructure with protected bike lanes or better markings, for example, you will increase the ridership in those areas. And so this makes sense as well with the electric charging infrastructure.
So in your paper, you say EV adoption has reached or is approaching a tipping point in many leading markets. I don't think here in Utah.
Yeah, so one example, I just came back a week or so ago from living in Denmark for the year, and vehicle sales the last handful of months, 95%+ have been electric of new vehicles purchased. And that tipping point is well past in areas like that. It's I was at my son's school over there and counted the number of cars while I was on a phone call. About 30 cars went by. Not a single one was a fossil fuel vehicle. They were all electric. And so just an example of this ship has sailed in many areas. In Utah, not so much. Coming back, it's definitely an adjustment that I'm currently observing. And but within 8 years, we could see a dramatic shift in that, again, with supportive policies and especially with financial incentives behind. We used to have an incentive for purchasing electric vehicles. What was $7,500, I believe, tax incentive. So with incentives like that reinstated, I think we could see some significant adoption.
So having been in Denmark and seeing this widespread adoption, what do you think has promoted that in Denmark?
Definitely supportive government of adopting less carbon emitting infrastructure, and that's a huge part of it. And also there is the infrastructure there to support the adoption of those vehicles, and here we have the opposite case. We don't have a supportive any supportive policies currently for the adoption. In fact, we have the opposite occurring against renewables and electric vehicles. And so it is something that we would have to see a dramatic shift in to see a sea change between now and then.
And some might say Denmark, smaller country. Yeah. And you might not be worried at exhausting a charge going from one end of the country. I don't know. I might have my geography all out of whack with Denmark. But certainly, wide open west, that's a worry. You're gonna exceed your charge and not find a station to charge.
Now, I will say the same is the case. About the same percentage of adoption, slightly more. I think it was 97% of vehicle sales in Norway were also electric in the last month or two. And that is more of a wild west of Scandinavia. And so you have large open spaces that are rural, and yet you also see a vast majority of vehicles are electric.
Yeah. So you're also suggesting, I think, that, governments adopt electric vehicles, people hauling things.
Absolutely.
Fleets, adoption.
I think even
widely.
Here in northern Utah, we see our Amazon delivery trucks. They are all Rivian electric vans. Amazon is committed to purchasing 100,000 electric vehicle vans for their delivery of their products by 2030, and they're well over halfway there. And so they, with this partnership with Rivian, they're demonstrating that electrified fleets of vehicles are feasible. And Roz and I were just talking with some people at Park City in terms of, you know, Park City already has electric buses for the city buses, and they're working effectively. And so we know that they're feasible. Zion National Park has electric buses for the tourists. And so this can easily be adopted by other communities in order to try to facilitate this transition to an electrified transportation system.
So if we get closer to a tipping point, we get a lot more of us driving electric vehicles, is that going to strain the electric grid?
Well, and so that's another one of our proposals, is that we need to expand renewable energy development throughout the state of Utah. And, you know, there's kind of a myth out there that somehow if we put too much wind turbines and solar panels on rural communities, that that's somehow going to hurt food production. The reality is that farmers are hurting because of tariffs. They're hurting because of, you know, lost labor because of ICE. And so they need other types of income. And so leasing their land to host renewable energy projects such as wind and solar can bring economic opportunities to these rural communities. They fund schools because the tax revenues that are generated. And so there are a lot of benefits for developing renewable energy. And so we believe that within the next 8 years, we can get that message out and encourage renewable energy development to better support, you know, the need for electrified buildings and electrified transportation.
And just to add one thing, expansion of renewable energy into agricultural lands doesn't have to be an either or situation. So you can stack functions by adding solar panels onto farms through agrivoltaics and growing food underneath and around solar panels, and or having livestock grazed. This is already happening in many areas surrounding Utah. Colorado is one example of farmers who are exploring this within their orchards, and also with livestock grazing and large-scale grain production. So there's some innovation happening around us that could be adopted. So I caution people from making the assumption that putting solar on farms means taking farms out of production, and it doesn't have to be that way. And especially if you have policies clarifying that solar implementation in a community would need to stack functions on agricultural land, that would be extremely beneficial.
Now, sometimes we see, and I don't know if this is a reality, well, I know it's not a reality from reading your paper. Sometimes we view this as a red state, blue state thing. The blue states are supportive and have a lot of renewable energy, and red states don't. But I think Idaho has a higher, much higher percentage than Utah does.
So here's the irony, and we actually point this out. Now, these are government statistics, but many red states have massive renewable energy portfolios. And so we talk about how Idaho, I don't have the statistic right in front of me. I think it's in the article there. What is it? 69% of their electricity comes from renewable sources.
Yeah, 69.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Idaho, another conservative state, already sees the benefits of, you know, renewable energy development. And that has benefited their rural communities, their farmers, their ranchers. And Utah, I think we just need to open up our eyes and see what other states are doing. Kansas, most of the electricity comes from wind. Now, we don't have the wind resources here in Utah, but we do have the solar. We're one of the best places for solar energy. And this is, I think this is an opportunity that we can develop, particularly solar with batteries. Has now become battery technology has become increasingly cost effective. And so this is something that I think the Olympics can point to and perhaps motivate the state to move in this direction.
So geothermal as well, you mentioned that.
Yes.
State leaders are kind of pinning their plans on nuclear.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
So, well, nuclear may very well be our future, but it's 20 years away. Mm. The benefits of renewable energy, number one, does not use water. Okay, wind and solar do not use water. Nuclear, at least as how we understand it now, does use significant amounts of water. So we need to figure out, if we're going to go nuclear, where that water is going to come from. So the bridge to nuclear should be built out of renewables because it's cost effective, doesn't use water. It's the cheapest form of electricity we have now, particularly solar during the day, you know. And it brings economic opportunities to rural communities. So I think those are three important things that we need to consider as we think about our energy future.
couple of the arguments against renewables, I'll just read from the paper here.
Yeah.
Some leaders are favoring fossil fuels, believing that increased levels of variable wind and solar, so variability, not reliable, is the charge you hear, and we talked about taking lands out of food production, and you've talked about that. Also destabilizing Utah's power grid.
Yeah, but here's the thing. These other red states have figured it out. I mean, if Idaho can get 69% of their electricity from renewables, why do they have the solution and we don't, you know, in terms of Utah? I think we can figure it out, you know. I think one of the plans is in order to capture a lot of that excessive renewable energy that we have during the day, solar during the day, one of the proposals is to actually get it into electric vehicles during the day. And one of the ways that can happen is that if employers put charging station infrastructure into their parking lots, so that way their employees can get free electricity as a perk. There's a group called Leaders for Clean Air, and that is the mission of this particular nonprofit organization here in Utah, is to get employers to put charging infrastructure into their parking lots as a perk. We've done some calculations. It costs about $3 to charge up an electric vehicle with wholesale rates that businesses enjoy. You know, that's a cup of coffee in the break room, you know. And again, this is still kind of at the beginning of the, you know, of this particular innovation. But we believe that if we can get, you know, many employers throughout not just Salt Lake, but throughout Utah to have charging stations in their parking lots, that will knock down one of the key barriers as to why people do not want to adopt an electric vehicle. I mean, if you knew that you could charge up your car every day when you go to work, and you don't have to charge every day, you only need to charge maybe once a week because you'll get sufficient, you know, charge for your week of driving, that can be a barrier that can be eliminated through this, you know, this particular proposal. And so perhaps Olympic sponsors may consider moving in this direction by putting in charging stations, because that will help electrify our transportation system.
One more, I guess, perceived objection or hurdle to electric vehicles, and this is one I've kind of looked at. I, you know, flirted with the idea, and then found at least the electric vehicles I was interested in are a little too rich for my blood. So at least a perception that they're a little too expensive for some people.
Yeah, and I think, and there's been many studies that have suggested that even though if you do pay more for an electric vehicle up front, you do save on charging. My daughter took one of our Teslas up to Idaho, and so she has to charge once a week. I get the bills because I, you know, it's on my credit card. But to charge her car is about $10 to $15, whereas if we were to fill that up with gasoline at $4 a gallon, that would probably be about $75 or plus. So there are cost benefits in terms of having, you know, an electric vehicle.
No, okay. Yeah, savings over time. Yeah. And I guess at some point we'll get maybe a more robust used electric vehicle market, hopefully, right, if we reach tipping point. Let's take another break. We'll come back and talk about more of your solutions. We're talking with three USC researchers, Edwin Stafford, Rosalind Brain, and Randy Martin. They're authors of a paper titled The Utah 2034 Winter Olympics, Leaving a Lasting Clean Air Legacy. We'll have more following this break.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. Programming support comes from our members and the Quinney College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at USU, with a degree in nutrition that helps prepare students with a background in how foods and nutrients impact health, disease, and physical performance. Information at ndfs.usu.edu.
We're facing a water crisis, and some say bringing back beavers, nature's original engineers, will help.
So they're out there repairing the river system that we damaged for over 300 years. They're just doing it.
We traipse through soggy meadows to see what happens when we leave it to beavers on the next Big Picture Science.
Tune in Sunday morning at 11 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with three USU professors, researchers, Edwin Stafford, Rosalind Brain, and Randy Martin. They are authors of a paper titled The Utah 2034 Winter Olympics, Leaving a Lasting Clean Air Legacy. And that's in the August edition of the Journal of Sustainability and Climate Change. They're suggesting that here's a spur to action, the coming 2034 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. And they're suggesting several solutions to our air quality problem. So, Edwin Stafford, I think you say in the paper that maybe any one of these by itself may not be enough, but if we combine all of these potential solutions, hopefully it'll be in the next 8 years.
Absolutely.
Get a handle on the air quality problem.
Absolutely. And so, you know, our other proposals are, you know, restoring the Great Salt Lake. Randy was talking about PM10, and that's one of the, you know, the dusts that is, you know, being blown into our valleys and impacting our food and the snowpack. We also talk about education outreach and the importance of engaging young people who will probably be volunteers for the Olympic Games. And so sensitizing them to what are some of the challenges that we're facing. So we're recommending that. Expanding our air pollution monitoring. I think Randy can talk more on that.
Yeah, that was one of my opportunities that I basically forced Ed to put in the paper. I think it's an opportunity to increase awareness and our understanding of the impacts on events such as the Olympics would bring into the Valley. By targeting very specific locations, we can show how successful any of these mitigation strategies you suggest might be. So I would ideally like to see this enhanced monitoring begin well before the Olympics, continue through the Olympics, and then after the Olympics as well, and really get a better picture of how successful these strategies could be.
What kind of air monitoring do we have now, and how far do we have to expand it to get to where you want us to go?
Well, most of the air monitoring are state-authorized stations, and there's a dozen of them or so in the Salt Lake Valley or along the Wasatch Front. And I would like to see them more stationed at the venues, Park City, for example, and not only include PM2.5, but also things like oxides of nitrogen, carbon monoxide, even ozone, with all that's usually not a problem in the winter. There are these low-cost sensor networks that are out there. Perhaps you've heard of Purple Air or TELUS. Those are not certified air quality analyzers, although they give us a general state of the air pollution. Those are really focused on particles. The low-cost gas sensors haven't been proven yet as far as a reliable technology, but maybe in 8 years they will be. So I'd like to see kind of the suite of normal pollutants that we look at expanded so we have a denser network of the samplers that we could really see what the air quality is and inform the public and inform the athletes of what their potential exposures are.
So the Great Salt Lake, a lot of discussion of everyone on this program as well. What are you suggesting as the key points to save the lake?
Well, we need to get water there, to get more water. And so there needs to be incentives. I know that the Trump administration is offering $1 billion for us to help save the lake. And so I'm hoping that money can be used to create incentives to funnel more water into the lake.
I would add that Dr. Kevin Perry out of the University of Utah did a little study where he looked at different potential remediation scenarios outside of just putting water back in the lake, and they were all costly. So the best thing is really just to get the water back in there.
In the billions of dollars, I think.
In the billions of dollars, yeah.
So
tens of billions of dollars.
If we do let a large portion of the lake go to playa, it's going to be very costly to get it back. One thing I forgot to do when we were talking about electric vehicles, I put exclamation points next to this in your paper. Electric flying taxis. That sounds very futuristic.
Yes.
And cool.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there was a demonstration here last summer. And what was so remarkable about this was how energy efficient these taxis are. I don't have the statistics right in front of me. I think they're in the article there. But, you know, it was something to the effect that the amount of electricity to go a certain distance with these electric taxis was like only $17. But if you used gasoline for a traditional helicopter or, you know, craft, it was going to be like $700. So, I mean, these electric taxis, at least how they're unfolding, look like they have a lot of potential. Now, one of my expertise or specialties is diffusion of innovation and looking at, you know, a radical new innovation and how do you get, you know, your first adopters or your innovators to actually adopt this technology. Right now here in Utah, these flying vehicles are being used to transport medical supplies and things to rural communities. So we're getting some experience with this. When I talk about this with my students, they say, heck no, I'm not going to get on one of those. We don't know how safe they are, et cetera. And so what we need is we need to get that social proof. We need to get demonstrations of how this is working. And if it is successful in terms of delivering medical supplies and things, that will then allow people to think, hey, maybe it'll be safe for people to actually be, you know, flying on these things. But I think a lot of others have already noted that that may very well be how we get people to various events. Instead of being stuck in traffic, we may have these flying taxis as a way to get people around the state to where they need to be.
One of your solutions, expand green infrastructure, including green roofs, right, which I've heard of, right, and green walls, which I have not heard of.
Yeah.
I've probably seen it, maybe. I don't know. Tell me about this.
I would say this is thinking more in the long term of benefits of shifting to having more in green infrastructure in and around Salt Lake. And if you look at urban heat island effect, for example, the heat that comes off of pavement, and you've experienced that walking down a very wide Utah street and just feeling that heat radiate off of that. Well, one example is in Paris this last year in August. They saw temperatures in those areas of exposed pavement of 104 degrees, and yet under tree canopy cover, it dropped 20 degrees, so 84 degrees Fahrenheit. And so just a huge potential with a pretty simple implementation of tree canopy cover. And not that that necessarily will absorb PM 2.5, as we've been talking about, but will help with alleviating these temperature surges that we're seeing in the state, and hopefully will result in long-term shifts when it comes to how hot we're getting in Utah and the associated lack of snowpack with that.
Yeah. Encourage electrified and efficient buildings. We talked about vehicles, but electrified and efficient buildings, mm-hmm. What are we talking about there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. About 40% of our air pollution comes from stationary sources, such as restaurants, paint shops, laundromats, you know, places where there's emissions coming out. So if we can electrify a lot of those things, that can eliminate the burning of fossil fuels on site. And so one of my projects I'm actually working on with my daughter, Victoria, is encouraging induction stoves to be used in commercial kitchens. And so we actually had a demonstration project. A celebrity chef, Chef Chris Garlaza, came down in May to Salt Lake City to actually do a demonstration for various restaurateurs and entrepreneurs in the restaurant industry to show how induction technology can replace gas stoves. And they're easy to clean. They're extremely efficient. They cook, you know, in a heartbeat, much more efficient than gas. And yet a lot of chefs are still not sure of that technology. So again, it's a kind of a diffusion issue. How do we get those first adopters to, you know, check out the technology, and as social proof, as other people adopt it, then people will recognize that an electrified kitchen can be so much more efficient than a traditional gas.
There's large economic savings there, especially at the point of construction. So I live in a 100% electric home in Moab, Utah, in a walking, biking only community, and we didn't run any gas line to our house whatsoever, and so we don't pay any gas bill. And it would go so far if we had policies that made it harder to put gas towards our homes. There's, at this point with the technologies, there's really no need to even run that line to your house. And people want it potentially, but there are large scale health and environmental impacts with having that. And so it's a consideration we should be making. And I'll just at the policy level say one thing to go back to our conversation about the Great Salt Lake. When we look at potentially $1 billion coming our way from the administration in 2027 year. It's not fully approved yet, but if that money does come our way, then we need to take a hard look at potentially caps on our growth around the Great Salt Lake watershed, and which will help steer our water towards the lake, and caps on the consumption at the home level. We Utahns use an astounding amount of water for landscaping. It's absurd, and it's cheap and easy. If we have a water crisis in our state, why is that the case? And maybe we need to look at higher incentives towards alternative landscaping, and stop calling it alternative landscaping and it becomes the norm of landscaping. That would be a dream. And there's a long way we can go currently with what I consider relatively minor sacrifices and potentially major gains for people when it comes to adopting these.
In the other opportunities, you've mentioned these a little bit, Rosalind Brain, but electrifying snow removal and yard equipment, carpool, you know, simple, have idle-free zones, some things that are being done some places, but maybe need wider adoption.
Yeah, let me speak to carpooling and tie in a larger issue that all of us have observed since the pandemic, is we've lost a bit of our sense of community, and it's playing out in the isolation that many are feeling across America. And carpooling is just one example of ways to regain that. Catching a ride with a colleague or a friend to work, and you can legally sit in the passenger seat and shoot text messages and look on your phone and not worry about the safety of that as a passenger, and save money in the process, and also build stronger social networks, which is desperately needed in our society. So the huge benefits with carpooling. I was dropped off here in Logan by my family who are heading down to Moab, and I'm carpooling back to Moab when I'm done with my work up here for the next several days. So it's something that is easy to do and has a lot of benefits. So,
Finally, before we say goodbye, this is just kind of stuck in my brain there, and it's frivolous, but I want to ask about this. So some people, when we talk about bad air, and especially with events, they mostly jokingly talk about using big fans. Has that ever been tried? Now, it's not going to help the people in the next neighborhood over, but maybe if you're at Rice Eccles Stadium and you want to have good pictures for the Olympics, you could bring out a big fan?
No, not to my knowledge that ever been tried. Oh, about every 3 or 4 years, one of the classes I teach, I do an assignment where we do a geoengineering type calculations to see what it would take in order to blow out, say, Cache Valley. And the shorter answer is, if you want to blow it out in one day, you're moving in Cache Valley alone about 13 trillion cubic feet of air. And you would have to build essentially a nuclear power plant the size of Palo Verde just to accomplish that one task. And so it's not economically possible. I mean, we've done things. What if you drill holes in the Wellsville Mountains and let it drain out that way? And it's fun to sit down and do those calculations, and theoretically, you know, we could construct such a thing, but it's just, no, it's not economically possible. You can't do it in a fast enough time period to make any kind of difference.
Okay, yeah, I'm glad I asked. You know, we've thought through some of these things. Yep. Yeah. Finally, what's it going to take? Adoption of a lot of these things, right, to have clean air by the 2034 Olympics, but I guess let me phrase it this way: what should people do if we're all nodding our heads and agreeing with you guys? What should we do? Call our congressman? What carpool? I guess what should we do?
Well, and I think you're right. I think we should reach out to policymakers to get policymakers to see what needs to be done in order to stage the Olympics and to demonstrate that Utah is a world class community and that we have world class ski facilities, and we have world-class air, you know. I think there's also engaging with the sponsors of the Olympics, so that way they can see what is it that they need to step up to in order to make these games a big success and not have the risk. We're going to have 500,000 guests descending into Utah, 500,000, so 500,000 people, all of them driving, all of them using natural gas to heat their hotel rooms, all of them using natural gas to eat And all that's going to do is to potentially exacerbate the possibility of a big inversion cloud during the games. What can we do to eliminate those things? And so I think our sponsors, our legislators, I think the Olympic organizers, they all need to be aware of these things. And so do our citizens. I mean, we don't want to embarrass ourselves. The whole purpose of the Olympics is to bring tourist dollars here, to make so people will want to spend their vacation, winter vacation money here in Utah. And if we have a big pollution cloud, that's probably going to inhibit that opportunity.
Well, we'll leave it there. We've been talking with three USU professors, researchers, who are authors of a paper titled The Utah 2034 Winter Olympics, Leaving a Lasting Clean Air Legacy. That's in the August edition of the journal Sustainability and Climate Change. We've been talking with Randy Martin. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Rosalind Brand, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
Edwin Stafford, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest in our work.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
Ask an Expert, tips for preserving the harvest safely. It's peak canning season, and preserving bottled food is a long-held tradition for many Utahns. Whether you're a long-time canner or a first-time food preserver, it's important to stay up to date on best canning practices. There's always something new and possibly safer to learn and apply to your own kitchen/canning laboratory. But before you get started, be aware that there's not room for creativity in canning. Food preservation is a science and research-based practice. Even though Grandma or Uncle Don may have always done it this way, using researched and tested recipes with proper procedures will bring you the safest results. Few things are more discouraging than investing time, money, and effort into growing, harvesting, and preserving food only to have it spoil or cause illness. In addition, deviating from a tested recipe can alter the storability and flavor of your food. Once your food is processed, then you can get creative. For example, make tomato sauce as the tested recipe states, store it properly, and then when you open it, season it to your desired taste to make a marinara sauce, enchilada sauce, or tomato soup. As always, the USU Extension Food Preservation website has free tested recipes, how-to guides, and best practices, as well as answers to questions like, can I use sugar substitutes in jam recipes? Or, do I have to use a pressure canner? If you have other canning questions, the best option for finding safe, scientifically based answers for proper food preservation is to contact your local USU Extension office. You can also check out Extension's Preserve the Harvest online course.
A murder investigation leads to some unusual culprits.
Sir Isaac Newton!
I'm the real Albert Einstein.
In a world turned upside down by the nuclear age. The Physicists by Friedrich Dürrenmatt, starring Bruce Davison, John DeLancey, and Gregory Itzen. Next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide listener-supported service of Utah State University and the College of Arts and Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan. Also heard at upr.org or on the UPR app.